President Donald Trump wants a $1.5 trillion defense budget. That would be the largest ever. Meanwhile, he is threatening to escalate in Iran, and gas prices around the country are hitting $4 a gallon. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. This is your weekly libertarian review of news and culture from the editors of Reason Magazine. I'm your host, Peter Suderman, and today I am joined by my colleagues, Catherine Mengu-Ward, Matt Welch, and Nick Gillespie. Catherine, I want to start with you, and I want to read you something that Donald Trump posted on Easter weekend. Open the fucking strait, you crazy bastards, or you will be living in hell.
Too late.
Yeah. Happy Easter, right?
Yeah.
What do you make of all this? Is this a Reason-style guide appropriate?
It is. We do always reprint the profanity when it is used in a historically relevant way. So, you know, even if he'd gone even harder and put the G on the end there, it would have still been fine. The thing that is crazy about the Donald Trump of it all in this particular moment is he keeps pushing back the deadline. So actually right now we're just in the headlong rush toward deadline 87 in this war, which is, I believe, Tuesday at 8 p.m. So maybe some of you are listening to this after that deadline and the nuclear apocalypse has occurred. But I hope if the nuclear apocalypse has occurred, you're not listening to the Reason Roundtable.
Well, the threat isn't to use nukes. The threat is to bomb the... Oh, Matt Welch, is the threat to use nukes? Did I miss something?
No. Not at all. I mean, the threat is to obliterate power plants, desalination plants, and the usual passel of war crimes that he began threatening on March 21st. We are in hour 375 of the 48-hour deadline and in week six of a 4 to 5 week war. And one would probably start to suspect that the people who he's threatening are believing that he's less and less credible and that they can maybe wait him out. He has actually given indications of that in sort of a hot mic or irresponsibly leaked conversation he had in the White House several days ago, in which he complained that, you know, I could take the oil, but Americans aren't patient enough for me just to go and take the oil. So he's giving some nods to the very real fact that there is no public support for this war. It's been underwater from the beginning, and it's getting more underwater by the day. So if you're Iran and you hear him talking about even nuking, at some point you go, I don't think you're going to do it.
I was, to be fair, referencing the nukes that maybe the Iranians were going to have and get us with, not our nukes, but I recognize those also.
But that's fake news, right?
Yeah.
That Iran has nukes. Peter, I think you glossed over the way he ended that. I mean, I guess it's a Truth Social post that got reposted to Twitter. But he converted to Islam over Easter weekend because he says, praise be to Allah. At the end, President Donald J. Trump in all caps. So I think that's kind of the news here.
So there are people who are calling. I mean, part of there's two things here. One is the substance of it, and the other is the tone. And there are people who are saying that, you know, both of them are bad in different ways. There are people who are saying this is 25th Amendment stuff. This is impeachment stuff, right? This guy is crazy. He is not reliable. This is just so insane and out of the, like, any kind of norm, even for Donald Trump, that he's got to go. What do you think?
Is it?
Yeah.
Is it?
I think it's not.
I don't want him to be there, but, like, we're a little bit late for looking for 25th Amendment solutions.
And that is the idea that he's incapacitated mentally.
Yeah, and that like a majority or a plurality of his cabinet is going to march into Congress and say, you know what, I hate to do the 25th Amendment, but I, J.D. Vance, have certain amounts of morals and fidelity to the country's future. And that's just, it's not going to happen. Like, deal with the president that you have. This is the one that we have. This is what he does. This is how he's been acting and talking for the last 11 years. Congratulations us, but that is just the reality of the situation.
We've got three more years of this. Catherine, how do we deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, I do think Matt is right that the 25th Amendment and or the impeachment of it all is not going to be how we deal with it successfully, ultimately, partially because, as we said, no one seems to have the stomach for it. And also, you know, I do always think it's kind of odd that we have, you know, you can do the craziest policy thing imaginable and nobody 25th Amendment's about that. And then you kind of use some colorful language on Truth Social and people are like, are we back at it? Did he finally lose his mind? And I think we should at least be weighing both of those things equally.
I mean,
in the question.
To be fair, it's also we're coming off a presidency with Biden where the 25th Amendment was a legitimate cause for concern, especially after his June 24 debate, you know, performance. So, I mean, when I read, you know, something like, you know, Trump saying, you know, you crazy bastards, like it's obviously you could, it's on a continuum with where he started, but he is increasingly deranged in not only what he is doing, but the way that he is doing it. And I mean, it's been nice over the past couple of months, like he's had to moderate tariffs. He changed ICE policy because he responds to, you know, polls and to markets. But the war stuff is disturbing. And it's, you know, I don't think we need to get bogged down in a discussion of whether or not he should be removed for office from it. But I mean, it is absolutely terrifying that you have a president who clearly took us into a major war without any idea of what he was doing, what the point was, what the end point is, or anything like that. And it was galling over the weekend to see a bunch, you know, the shrinking pool of MAGA, you know, stalwarts, you know, talking about what an Easter holiday it was that the U.S. rescued two people who were in a plane that got shot down in Iran over a war that it's not clear what we're doing there, and that it's going to be really great when Trump successfully opens the Strait of Hormuz, even though it was open before we started this war. Like, you know, there's something very dark going on right now, and I don't know how to bring it to a successful political conclusion, but something's got to change.
And you used the word derangement at the beginning, Nick. Whenever people talk about Trump being deranged, you hear, oh, you're the one who has Trump derangement syndrome. Yeah. This is just how he negotiates. He's playing hardball. This is what he did with the tariffs. That's how he got us all of those great deals, right? Was he made threats. He used the power of the American empire to bring other countries, to bring them to the negotiating table and then to get what he wanted for the American people out of them.
We should just be open to the possibility that, in fact, everyone is deranged. Like Trump could be deranged and people could have Trump derangement syndrome. I think that is, in fact, the most parsimonious explanation.
Are you including yourself in this?
A little. Yeah. I feel a little crazy reading the news. I don't know.
I feel only a little crazy.
Sane as milk. I would just point out to your steel manning, Peter, that, you know, he just uses threats to get negotiations. That's why we got what in Greenland? What? What do we get out of that one? Oh yeah, Denmark like had to like maybe get their mine layers to go in. We dismantled NATO or were in the process of dismantling NATO, so that was a win, I guess. Some people are Ari Fleischer is spinning that as a win as well. This people have a memory of an afternoon, generally speaking, and so it's always art of the deal, even when those deals collapse and didn't bring anything and sowed enmity among people who used to be our friends and made things more expensive and crappy for Americans. I'm not going to buy that just now. If he somehow spins a beautiful win out of all of this, I will high five the guy.
What would a beautiful win look like to you? Like,
I'm just imagining even know what that Matt is. Getting tackled by a lot of Secret Service agents right now.
High five. It'll be a non-threatening high five.
Okay.
A win for me is kind of unimaginable, but let's say for the sake of imagination that Iran decides to obviously open the Strait of Hormuz, negotiate for emptying its political prisoners, prisons. By the way, the Iranian American polling numbers are just in the toilet now. At the beginning, there was people getting very, very happy in West LA and other places, and now it's like 2/3 are opposed. Emptying political prisoners, introducing some kind of very, very basic kind of reforms, dismantling huge chunks of the IRGC, IGRC, whatever the hell it is, and fill in the blank a bunch of other things that are never going to happen at this point because we just spent the whole time bombing the country and not doing anything meaningful with an opposition besides telling them 2 months ago, 2.5 months ago, like, go, your time is now. good luck.
I do think so many of the like wins or claims of that, you know, things are improving is they are all based on just starting the chart in a weird place, right? And like the Biden administration did this par excellence in actual charts. Like they would always be releasing like, you know, more jobs were created as long as you don't show the x-axis type stuff. But this is like accelerating and kind of becoming more widespread, I think, in the Trump administration. It's like we can really, really improve the situation from how it was 3 weeks ago when we caused it to degrade, but not from how it was 6 weeks ago before we did anything. And there's like an odd kind of amnesia or willingness to just say like, oh, yeah, I'll start the chart wherever it's advantageous to my tribe to start the chart.
Can we get a Venn diagram, a chart of some sort showing the overlap between war crimes and chart crimes?
Yeah, it's a circle.
Nick, what about the budget aspect of this? $1.5 trillion request in the White House budget for the Department of Defense, the Department of War, whatever we're supposed to call it now. That is a 43% increase, the largest year-over-year increase, I want to get this right, in military spending since the Korean War, if it went into effect. Now, this is a White House budget. We should say up front, nobody ever expects these things to go into effect, but it tells you what the White House's priorities are. And Trump has been running around saying, look, we can't afford all these healthcare programs. We can't afford to do stuff at home. We got to fund the military. That's what we have to do.
Yeah. I mean, the defense budget proposal is ridiculous on its face. It will be listened to. And I think a Republican Congress will work like hell to get something across the finish line that reflects Trump's priorities, sadly. The other thing, you know, before the midterms, when, you know, what is going to become the political story for the next 3 years, hopefully, is what, if anything, does a Democratic majority, at least in the House, have as an agenda that is not just equally awful and going in a different direction. But I think with Trump, you know, with things like the budget, you know, the one thing that we have learned over our entire lifetimes, you know, run concurrently or consecutively, however you want, which is that there's always money for everything. You know, the federal government has not actually ever been like, well, you know, you can have guns or butter. It's like, why not both? And this
there's always money until there's not.
Right.
This is the thing. If you have ever read a Congressional Budget Office report, there's money until there's not.
Right. And we haven't hit that point yet. But we will, you know, and maybe over the next few years.
Peter, your boy, Douglas Holtz Eakin at the former director of the CBO in the New York Times was quoted today or this weekend saying they're not even pretending to try. And my girl, Maya McGuinness, who is the president of the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget, said, this is the most number-free budget we've seen in recent history. I have to imagine there's a story the numbers would tell that they don't want to tell. Like our bros are in despair. Our budget bros are in despair. What can we do?
I don't know. Matt, what can we do?
You know, well, if just real quick, though, to go back, like, as I was thinking about this, I interviewed Ro Khanna, the progressive capitalist from who represents California's 17th district, which includes San Jose, Santa Clara, Cupertino. You know, he's the congressman from Silicon Valley, and he spends a lot of time bitching at billionaire tech billionaires and trying to levy, you know, billionaire taxes and wealth taxes against people both in California and the United States. But we you know, and it's a wide-ranging conversation, but like we kind of got into it a little bit. Like, why are we spending $7 trillion now compared to, you know, $4.5 trillion before COVID, like in 2019? And he doesn't have a good answer for that. And that's why we're going to keep spending more. Because if you could say, you know, COVID is over, the war in Afghanistan, the global war on terror, we won that, right? We brought the boys home and everything like that. You could have a credible conversation about going back to, you know, 2019 pre-COVID levels of spending. But nobody anywhere in the government, with the exception of maybe Rand Paul and Thomas Massie, even pretend like there was a time before $7 trillion budgets. And that is really, really bad. And it's going to doom, you know, doom us over the next few years for sure.
Well, the answer to that question, why are we spending $7 trillion? No, it's just that we've got a budget that's built on autopilot spending that transfers money from young workers to old rich retirees. We're going to talk about that in a minute. Matt, go ahead. 10 years ago?
10 years ago, I wrote a cover story for Reason Magazine, Free Minds, Free Markets, called Debt Denialists, which was pegged off the 2016 election, and just talking about how no national politician of significance has even made politics out of, let alone policy out of, caring one whit about the debt or the deficits since basically the day after the midterms in November 2014. It was over since then. People like to make a lot of hay out of, like, well, Donald Trump said he'd get rid of the debt. He has said everything at some point. He's never made politics out of it. He's made politics out of crucifying Paul Ryan and everything he stood for. But his actual politics are of welfare status, in the sort of Marine Le Pen kind of mode in France. If we had kept spending based on where we were 10 years ago, right now, adjusted for inflation, we'd be spending about $5.6 trillion right now. We're not. We're spending $7 trillion right now. There is no appetite for this. And so the conversation is going to go into two directions, I predict. One is that there will be a lot of talk about raising the cap on Social Security contributions for people who get up to the threshold. I forget what it is now, 135,000 or something.
It's like 175 or 178, something like that.
Okay. So it'll be to raise that cap and then also be chop off benefits to the ones who get the most money at the top. So you'll see that on one hand, but on the other hand, and this speaks to your $1.5 trillion defense budget, we are going to be in a global arms race for the foreseeable future. And so there are going to be kind of a difficult set of politics of anyone standing athwart that particular bit of contemporary history and yelling stop. Because when alliances fall down, which they are doing right now, then you are going to be looking out for your own, and your own costs money.
Catherine, I want to take you back about 25, maybe even 30 years to a time when we were in high school. And then a couple of years, sort of the period right after that college, and when you were working at the Weekly Standard.
Every week.
I know, we're talking about the war in Iran. Okay. And the Weekly Standard was like, well, this war in Iraq, pretty good, but we could do a war in Iran too, right? But there was a thing that was said at the time from the Oval Office. George W. Bush, a phrase he liked to use, nation building at home. And the idea was, hey, all these foreign wars are pretty stupid because they're really expensive. And what we need to do is invest in America. And Trump kind of ran on nation building at home. I don't think he used those words, but he basically said, hey, all these foreign forever wars are really expensive and really stupid. We need to be investing in America. This was the populist thing that he said to win the Republican primary and the election twice. And now he's running around saying it is not possible for us to take care of daycare, Medicaid, Medicare, all these individual things. They can do it on a state basis. You can't do it on a federal. We have to take care of one thing, military protection. We have to guard the country. He's cutting domestic spending so that he wants to cut domestic spending so that we can increase the defense budget.
Yeah, I was going to give cold props to the fact that he is at least saying words that imply that he understands that there are trade-offs, right? Like, he is at least sort of kind of proposing cuts, although he is not touching entitlements at all in those proposed cuts.
And also the cuts that he's making don't come close, anywhere close to offsetting the increases he is proposing.
My expectations are so low. My expectations are in hell. And so somebody saying any words that imply that they understand the fungibility of dollars feels good to me. The fact that those budget cuts the domestic cuts will almost certainly not occur, or will occur at a scale that doesn't match the increase in defense spending, is something that Republicans have long done, right? Republicans do sometimes in those 30 years that you just referenced, said words that sound like we should cut the government and especially domestic spending. But it is either then outweighed by increases in defense spending or was just bluster.
But there's also all this kind of automatic entitlement spending. Nick, you wrote a cover story more than a decade ago for a reason on generational warfare.
Right.
Basically arguing that the way the budget was set up, the way the federal spending works is a huge amount of it is just transfers from young, not as wealthy workers to relatively rich seniors. Right. There's a new study out from Wharton. I don't know if you guys saw this, showing basically per capita federal spending on each age group. And for children and young adults, it's $4,300 on average. And for seniors, it is $43,000, a little more than that, 10 times for rich seniors versus young adults.
Yeah, part of that is also, it's not fully fair because states spend a lot of money on kids if you count K through 12 education. And of course, co-ed soccer leagues, which, you know, have destroyed American exceptionalism over the years. But what worries me the most, we are beginning to have generational warfare, which I think is good and is long overdue. But what worries me the most about it is that it is not going to be Social Security was created in the middle of the Great Depression for, and it addressed a problem poorly, but it addressed a problem that has not existed since, you know, FDR won his last term in government. And so we're going to get rid of that and come up with a way to make sure that seniors do not starve or have to eat cat food and dog food, you know, in their retirements. And instead, what it is going to do is blow out the cap on Social Security earnings so that, you know, like upper middle class people end up spending more money. It doesn't really affect rich people, et cetera, but kind of the scenario that Matt was talking about. And then shoveling a lot more money at younger people because, you know, I took out, you know, $500,000 in order to get a master's in something. And now I'm saddled with student debt and things like that. So what has not come into the view yet, which I think really needs to and ultimately will be forced to when all of the entitlement trust funds come, you know, come up short in a given year, is like we need to reduce spending. Like you cannot just keep going from, you know, $5 trillion a year to $7 trillion a year to $9 trillion a year and expect any way to pay for that or to have an economy that functions particularly well. So I'm happy about generational warfare. Like the first shots have been fired, but I feel like this is going to be a war where everybody loses.
Yeah, just like the Iran war. Did you guys see, speaking of generational warfare, this is having some like weird effects on sort of how people think about their own economic status, right? You talked about the upper middle class, Nick, here. There's this insane story in the New York Times from a couple of days ago. Student debt burdened them, so they moved abroad and stopped paying. And like the signature anecdote in this story is someone who was paying $60 a month, 60. Not 600, not right. This is, you know, not, this isn't government money, right? This is this is the price of one Substack. And this person was paying $60 a month and was like, no, this is too much. Is like it's a psychological burden. So I'm going to move to Prague. Matt, you moved to Prague once.
Yeah. And that was the move. People would go there and like they can't do anything now that I'm here. it's pre-internet. So that was more plausible than it is now. When the global financial system has been created to squeeze every last dollar out of every last American, no matter where they live. Everyone peaced out. There used to be a some provision that if you're doing some kind of work abroad, that they're like, okay, we know what you're doing. Just like start paying when you come back home. I'm pretty sure they've closed that loophole over the years. But you know, people who are in their 20s are really, really stupid. They are some of the stupidest people you can imagine. There's long hair and earrings and stuff. Terrible, terrible stuff.
I just want to note that we have already spent the week alienating boomers with Eric Boehm's excellent feature on boomers using government money to pay for like their golf course memberships. So go ahead and alienate the 20 somethings too, Matt. Yeah. It's fine.
That's fine.
One of the things about the student loan issue, which will keep coming back and things like that. You know, if there's about $1.6 trillion, or that's a figure that gets thrown around a lot for total student loan, almost all of that is for graduate level or professional programs. So it's like, you know, going to law school or medical school, or, you know, getting an MA or a PhD in something. And when you look at what the typical undergrad borrows, the typical undergrad who borrows, they come out of, you know, a program with about 30 to 35 grand in student loan debt for 4 years for getting a BA, which tends to, on average, increase their earnings. I mean, it's essentially a car payment. And the what bothers me the most about the student loan, you know, kind of narrative, and I took out student loans to go to undergrad, as well as a few for grad school. So I you know, I benefited from the program and I used it generally judiciously, all of that kind of stuff. But when you leverage or you arbitrage what is these loans are actually being used for, people who are going to college to get a BA to do something. And then suddenly you're talking about oftentimes people who are doctors who will take out hundreds of thousands of dollars in loans to become a doctor because they know they're going to pay it back quickly and ahead of time, or to go to law school, or to go to get a master's or a PhD. I did all those, you know, I did those two things and I'm happy that I did. I paid my own way, but it's like, stop, you know, stop bitching and moaning about your useless master's degree. That makes you, means you go to Prague and you stop paying, and trying to make the, you know, put that on the back of student loans that most people are using incredibly responsibly to get an experience that they wouldn't get otherwise. It's very frustrating.
According to reports, she graduated from the University of Oregon with a master's degree in historic preservation.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
Mm-hmm. No, I love that. I mean, I, you know, follow your bliss, but then don't fuck it. You know, like, at no point could she have possibly known. I don't know how many of you took out student loans. Like, and this, I'm going back 30 years and they wouldn't shut the fuck up. This is how much you will pay for how long. Every month, here is the principal, here is the interest, here is this big, thick booklet that you have to go through again and again until it's all gone. Like, nobody takes out a student loan without knowing exactly how much they're taking out, how much they're going to have to pay every month, et cetera. It's very frustrating. And the idea that somebody like that deadbeat is then going to be taxing, people who might not have even graduated high school in order to cover the loss on that loan. It's just really awful.
All right. Speaking of paying the bills, we've got to do a little bit of that ourselves. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, a listener question on healthcare. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. So you know what makes people worry? Money problems. Financial stress. At the start of this year, 88% of Americans reported feeling some form of financial stress. Money worries often bring anxiety, sleep disruption, even depression. Financial difficulties are also one of the leading sources of conflict for couples. If you are struggling with money or feelings of anxiety around your finances, that doesn't mean you failed. It might just mean that you need to find the right kind of support. And that is where therapy from BetterHelp comes in. Therapy is not about financial advice or telling you how to invest. It's about managing your stress. It's about figuring out what to do with all of the frustration that can come with financial difficulties. It's about helping you build better coping strategies so that you don't feel alone. BetterHelp is going to help match you with a therapist using a short questionnaire. If you're not happy with the match, you can switch to a different therapist anytime. These recommendations are tailored directly to you. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform. BetterHelp has served over 6 million people globally, and it works. BetterHelp has an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session, and that's based on over 1.7 million client reviews. So when life feels overwhelming, therapy can help. Sign up, get 10% off at betterhelp.com/roundtable. That's betterhelp.com/roundtable. All right. We love to answer your questions. Please send your short, succinct, pithy, and otherwise not very long questions to podcasts@reason.com. That's podcasts@reason.com. And please put listener question in the subject line so that we know that it's a listener question. This week's listener cue comes from Bob, who writes, "Dear Roundheads." When did we become Roundheads? I don't know. "I subscribe to the Picayune Sentinel, a Substack newsletter by a retired opinion columnist with the Chicago Tribune. He's always been a lefty, a progressive, but a thoughtful lefty and a good listener. Not surprisingly, the vast majority of his Substack subscribers are also lefties. Recently, he wrote about the Democratic primary contenders competing for Dick Durbin's Illinois Senate seat. They all supported Medicare for all. I got into posting exchanges, several heated, with some of his lefty subscribers about what a disaster Medicare for all, whatever that means, would be as a replacement for the current system. The U.S. healthcare system does need to be reformed. So what libertarian reforms would you recommend, Catherine?
Yeah, this is sort of a great moment to just remember making it one bigger thing is not going to fix it. Like, a big part of the problem with our healthcare system is how much it is dominated by large, big, dumb government operators. I would say the libertarian solution is to, you know, fundamentally deregulate it and break it up. And so the things that healthcare and health insurance in this country right now are doing are like five or six different functions all lumped into a single product, which is overregulated. So we've got like routine care stuff, none of which should be covered by insurance anyway. I should just be paying out of pocket when I go to get my annual checkup and my teeth cleaned and all that kind of thing. Those aren't things you need to insure. Those are things you budget for. Then we could have something like catastrophic plans. We've talked about those a lot on this podcast. I think that's, you know, a good model. That is what insurance actually is. What if a disaster happened and I could pay a little in advance to insure against that disaster ruining me? And then Nick would want me to say that a good society does not let its poor, you know, bleed out in the street in front of the emergency room, which is true. I think that could mostly be handled with private charity. But if we must, we could talk about a government program there that would be run as a charity program and not under this like weird umbrella of providing health care and health insurance for the whole country. Medicare for all would make all those things worse and stupider. We shouldn't do it.
Nick, what do you think about this? And put it in the context of what we were talking about earlier with that Wharton study, generational warfare. How much money is being spent on Medicare in particular, which is a kind of, it's not quite literally Medicare for all, but it is a Medicare for all style program only for people 65 and up.
Right. Well, it is Medicare, right? I mean, and Medicare, if I'm remembering correctly from the story that Veronique DeRougie and I co-authored about generational warfare, Medicare by design was only going to cover less than half of its actual expenses through premiums and doctor fees and things like that. So, you know, Medicare for all is a guaranteed, like, you are going to bankrupt the country much faster than you would with Medicare for some, which is a problem. And Medicare in the late 60s, LBJ, who pushed the passage of it when it was signed, he called it the last act of the New Deal. Harry Truman was the first recipient of Medicare because he had tried to get national health care through. You know, to follow up on what Catherine was saying a couple of weeks ago, we talked about how one of the problems with DHS is that it took a bunch of poorly performing bureaucracies and rolled them all into one. You have something similar like that with the healthcare system since Obamacare, which was supposed to solve this. And it's clear trying to spend more money and get the government more involved in healthcare is not working to make it more affordable or better. So go in the other direction. And I like the idea, you know, first and foremost is making healthcare costs visible to the people who are either using the service or paying the costs. And this goes to, you know, Matt, who's an apologist really for John McCain. Yes. But John McCain in 2008, you know, part of his platform, probably the only good part in many ways, was that he said that, you know, we should repeal the tax deduction for healthcare benefits, you know, for people. And, you know, that would go a long way to start saying like, okay, how much are you actually spending on healthcare? I'm thinking about this a lot because I just had a kid. And we're still like sorting through bills and things like that. It is literally impossible to know how much you're spending anytime you buy anything that's related to, you know, the doctor, to doctor care or hospital care or anything like that. When you go to the, you know, the drugstore, by and large, you know, okay, that, you know, it costs $5 or it costs $500. Bringing back market signals into the healthcare system would be a good start to making it more efficient.
Matt, in addition to being an apologist for John McCain, you are also an apologist in the pages of Reason magazine for French healthcare.
Am I?
You have been.
Why I prefer French healthcare was the name of the piece, and it didn't advocate that we go to a French healthcare system, but it was to point out at the time that the consumer experience on the American level is frequently much worse than the French level, because we can't do a thing like go to the pharmacy and have the pharmacist say, "Ah, you're sick. Here's some, take this drug here." A lot of over-the-counter stuff, like basic medical needs, are taken care of on that level. The American system, as Nick pointed out, like the price signals are insane. I once remember went with my wife to the emergency room in LA when we were just dirt poor, went to a Kaiser, and she was just like vomiting everything up and like couldn't keep anything down. I'm like, okay, she's dying, so maybe we should go to the hospital. And so went to the hospital and like, look, she's dying and everything. It's very important, but like, if it's a lot of money, we just can't do this. So can you just sort of tell us how much money it is? They're like, yeah, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Keep coming through. And then at the end of that rainbow, I think of just like getting IV fluids, and this is in the late 90s, we were hit with a bill in the high four figures. And it's like, what part of like, we can't afford this, didn't you hear when we asked at every single step? And then that doctor cost this much and this doctor cost that much. Horrible. That's not the type of thing that happens in French.
You got IV fluids and it cost like the price of a used Corolla?
Yes. And I mean, back at the time that I wrote that piece, which is controversial, is in the deliberations for about Obamacare, is a reaction in part to generations of conservative and some libertarian healthcare analysts saying, we've got the best system in the world. What's the problem? Parts of the system are the best system in the world, but not all the parts of the system are the best system in the world. And there should have been more actual policy interest in making that system better. And the first and best thing that I think that can be done, piggybacking on what Nick and John McCain said, is the thing that they took off the table at the opening bid of the Obamacare discussions with Rahm Emanuel and Barack Obama, which is that let's not even talk about severing the link between employment and health insurance. Why do we have that link? Because of World War II and trying to get around price controls. That doesn't seem like it should be the foundation for a system, is to perpetuate that and all of the crazy disincentives that that produces.
Well, so do you think broadly that, if you couple the Depression and World War II as one thing, which I think is a legitimate way of seeing an era, it's like, those things are, 70 to 100 years old. We need a reboot. We could learn from the past, but there is no way to fix Medicare. And by expanding it to the entire population, that's not going to work. It's the same thing with Social Security. Like, these are programs that were designed for problems that are not the same anymore, with demography working totally against it. We're not going to be a massively growing population country or population of young people. And I mean, just to kind of call back to the generational warfare, I look forward to, as the boomers and the Xers exit the stage of like where, we will be around forever and we will be haunting you both in reality as well as in, living rent free in your brains long after we're gone. But this is the moment where like millennials and Gen X, Gen Z people can say like, okay, we inherited a world. Some parts of it are good, some parts of it are terrible, but now we have to recreate it in the same way that the policymakers in the World War, post-World War II era came up with something different. But like, it's over. And we really need to have serious conversations about what a healthcare system looks like, for the 21st century instead of for the late 19th century.
And the Medicare for Allists, it must be pointed out, and I did this in the controversial column way back when, don't spend a lot of time thinking about the trade-offs of creating such a system. French politics and French governance are broken and have been broken for generations, precisely because each new president comes in and says, maybe we're going to raise the retirement age from like 60 to 60 in 1 month. And they're like, burn the sheep and grind everything down to a halt. These programs require massive taxation on the middle class to afford it. The French economic system has not produced anything like youth employment for anyone for a real just generations now. We don't want that type of society in America. We just never have. Do you want the lines of the NHS? Do you want the kind of crazy stuff that happens up in Canada right now? You want some aspects of that stuff, but when you look at it holistically, as the entire kit and caboodle, there's a lot of negatives associated with that. And very, very few countries, Switzerland being one of them, have like figured out a way to sort of marry the two in a way that seems cognizant with American values.
If I may, at the risk that I'm willing to take and I'm willing to force on you guys of extending this segment, do countries with single payer healthcare, or better or worse, however defined, do they have as many medical procedural TV shows? Because everybody in my circles is talking about The Pitt, you know, and obviously which features a guy from ER and, you know, the words medical center and like Dr. Kildare and all of this stuff. Like, does every advanced economy have endless shows about how fucked up medicine is?
So here's this is something that I think about regularly. Michael Moynihan, late of Reason, now of God knows what, and the Fifth Column, telling a story about people.
Did he die because of the lack of healthcare?
People in Sweden who believed that they had the same civil liberties and civil rights as Americans because of watching police procedurals. Like, they would get arrested in Sweden. They'd be like, read me my rights. And the Swedish cops would be like, you don't have any. Give us your blood. You're going to prison indefinitely. Yeah. And
but it is a very nice prison.
It's a really prison nice, that's it looks better like than most middle class homes. It's lovely, yeah. but they don't have the same rights. And I wonder if we have the same thing. Like, are there people who go to hospitals in single payer systems expecting to see whatever's happening on The Pit? And they're like, hey, what's going on here, buddy?
I just want a house. Give me a house.
Me too. But, you know, we can't always have what we want.
So the question was libertarian solutions. And Matt told this story of in the 90s going to an emergency room and getting hit with a high four-figure bill is what you said. And the comparison I made was to a used Corolla, right? I just want people to get a sense of how absolutely lacking in cost control the American system is. And if you think about that, that is a result of no one having pricing, purchasing power themselves. The system is designed to hide the prices from everyone because it's all run through insurance or through government or through insurance that is regulated by government. And you just think about that in the context of Medicare for All, because Vermont tried to implement Medicare for All. Vermont, the state that keeps electing Bernie Sanders for senator. And they were like, this is way, way, way too expensive. So when Vermont can't do it because it's too expensive, that means that the rest of us definitely can't do it. There is simply no way to afford a Bernie Sanders Medicare for All style system on anything remotely like today's budgets, today's taxation. It would just destroy the economy, the budget as we know it. And so that system is a disaster. And what you want to do is you want to return power to individuals to make choices about their own healthcare decisions. There's a whole bunch of ways you can do that. You can end the carve out for employer provided healthcare. But the big thing that I think the most straightforward thing that you could do is you could radically expand HSAs, health savings accounts. It's a somewhat complicated procedure from Cato Institute's Michael Cannon, but he proposes very large health savings accounts. And what this basically does is it returns the money to you, which means the choices to you, makes all of this tax-free. It's like a big sort of tax bump in everybody's compensation, and also dramatically changes the way, like shifts the balance of purchasing power, of decision-making power in the American healthcare system all at once. It's the single most straightforward change that you could make. Very large HSAs. This is Michael Cannon's plan. I like it. I think it's like all of these healthcare plans, all of these healthcare ideas, right? It would take some messaging. It would take Republicans or someone to make the case for it. But it is a thing that you could do within the current system without completely blowing it up. And I think that matters. Okay, speaking of without blowing up, let's talk about space.
Rockets.
Mm. Catherine, you want to give us an Artemis update? We're going to the moon? To the fucking moon?
I would love to. I must note here and everywhere, nobody will be putting any feet on the moon, but still. No boots on the ground. But humans will be.
Like next year, right?
As no, please, girl. So we'll talk about that. First of all, I watched the launch from a bar in Charlottesville, Virginia, with Reason Science correspondent Ron Bailey, and it was delightful. There were a bunch of drunk people in the bar who just kept shouting, like, looks good, it looks really good, like they were literal rocket scientists. It was great. It did not blow up coming off the launch pad. Also want to complain to the authorities, the powers that be. There are four people on that vehicle right now, three astronauts and one Canuckanaut, which I think is a term that should exist and which doesn't exist. That's what we should call Canadian astronauts, right? Nobody else likes it. It's disappointing. Okay. So they're going around the moon. They're going to see stuff.
Exponauts.
They're going to see stuff that nobody has seen before. We're going to be farther from Earth than we've ever been, which is really cool. They took another blue marble picture so we can see the Earth in space, which is really cool. And Stuart Brand is probably happy about that. The next phase of the Artemis mission was supposed to be back to the moon. Now it will be Artemis 4 that is back to the moon. Artemis 3 will be about getting, kind of bridging the gap between low Earth orbit and going back to the moon, and private companies will be necessary for that. So that is exciting because it means that NASA can, in fact, however slowly, learn some lessons about how to behave and where to do subcontracting and how. And I'm excited, though I'm a little nervous about the potential SpaceX IPO, which I feel like could complicate some of this.
Why?
Well, you know, on the one hand, an IPO is great because then SpaceX will have a giant pile of money. That's what IPOs are for. Yeah, you get Elon a giant Musk pile of money. And having a giant pile of money to make more rockets is a thing that I like. On the other hand, there are always advantages to having a company be privately held, including less oversight, less potential kind of short-term focus. And I do worry about all those things having a negative impact on what I think remains the best thing about Elon Musk, which is his kind of maniacal long-term vision about being an interplanetary species.
So Matt and Nick, we spent a bunch of money on this mission. It's over budget. It was delayed, right? I mean, you can get very excited about it, like that kid in the video. We're going back to the fucking moon, right? Great, great video. Yeah. I love the enthusiasm there. But Matt,
it's such bad language, you know. Yeah. He's learning from the president.
Yeah,
right. But I want to ask you about sort of the history of the debate here, just because of what we talked about earlier on this show. If you go back to 1970 or so, the kind of the original moonshot era, there was a big debate that I think people have forgotten about in American politics about why are we wasting money going to the moon when we have real problems to solve here at home?
I mean, if you go back to the initial moonshot speech, which is one of the most analogized, grossly misanalogized speeches ever from JFK, it's actually a really interesting, really short speech in which he said, look, we're going to have to sacrifice a lot to get this done. And the last thing we need is a bunch of damn labor unions getting in the way. So knock that off just as an opening bid. And it was kind of about the system of trade-offs. Like, we have to hurry because the Sputniks got there first and we got to do something about that. Here we go. And so, yes, you're going to focus attention of reaching this goal. The goal is great. And then afterwards, people are like, okay, what else are we doing? So it. I think that made sense in the context of the time and in the Cold War. We've devoted how many hundreds of thousands of words in Reason magazine over the years about the risk aversion that then came along with that. And then just what happens when it's all administered by a bureaucracy. This wouldn't be happening, I do not believe, unless we'd had private space competition finally inaugurated, beginning at the end or during the Obama administration, just in terms of removing roadblocks for it. And it's great. Let's get back to space. Let's go do some cool stuff. And government will be part of that. But the private companies are pretty much leading the way in all of this. I don't think in a context of, modern monetary theory governing the way that we do federal budgeting, that there's a lot of people going to make a lot of political hay out of like, well, this one's expensive. We're just going to keep doing everything else that costs even more. That's not going to get that far. But let's be thankful and encourage more of the competition stuff and a lot of crazy billionaires who want to do stuff. I like that.
Never forget the very important canonical text produced during that first lunar era, Whitey on the Moon, which is about this exact trade-off. People starving in the streets, but Whitey's on the moon.
Thanks. There's a great, one of the first big series of socially conscious comic books came out in the early 70s, and Green Arrow and Green Lantern get into a pickup truck with one of the guardians of Oa and go to see the real America, which is unrelievedly a place where, you know, workers are being forced into, you know, prison camp like, environments to coal mine against their will, et cetera. And at one point, the thing that starts the whole journey through the heart of a disgusting America is an old elderly black man who comes up to Green Lantern and says, you know, you've saved all these people. You've gone to the moon. You've saved the blue people and the green people and the yellow people and the red people, but you've never done nothing for the black people. And it's coming out of that exact milieu, Catherine. And I highly recommend anybody who wants to understand comic books needs to look at these Denny O'Neill, Neil Adams comics. Brian Doherty and I used to laugh about them because they were kind of our introduction into, you know, real adult comic book type stuff. To bring that around to this, we go to the moon not because it is easy, but because it is super expensive and politicians get to, this is like risk-free. Because you know, if that machine blows up somewhere, they're going to be like, you know, fucking Elon Musk. We need to levy a billionaire tax against him. Like this, there is absolutely no reason that taxpayers should be doing this, or it should be so minimal because there are so many billionaires who want to do this. You know, I would like to, the only billionaire in space who's in space that I would like to be in space with is Richard Branson, but that's because I'd like to hang out with him, you know, at Necker Island or whatever his non-pedo island is. He seems like the most interesting guy to be in a capsule with. But I don't think that we should be spending as much on this. I think the federal government should get out of the way. But ironically, two things to end this. One is that this yesterday, 60 Minutes had a great segment about the California high-speed rail system, which has not laid one foot of track yet. And they've already said, oh, well, we're not going to go from San Francisco to LA. We're going to go from Bakersfield to Merced. So it's like, you know, and that is kind of amazing because, you know, at least as you guys were saying, NASA has opened things up or they're using the private sector and they're actually putting people further away from Earth than ever before. Whereas like California, which is like, no, this is a public good and we're going to do this. And they cannot even get a 19th century piece of technology off the ground or, you know, or moving on the ground, which is kind of amazing. And I'll just stop there.
I hope that Green Lantern comic is your cultural consumption because that's what we're doing next. Matt Welch, what do you have for us?
Went to the Staatsburg, long A, double A, state historic site. Up here where I'm taping this from in the Hudson Valley area. It's between Rhinebeck and Hyde Park. It's one of these Gilded Age mansions overlooking the Hudson River, of which there are 11 billion, or at least five real big ones. So there's a lot more. I recommend at some point hopping on a boat in Kingston and taking the kind of a mansion tour. They're pretty staggering. And every time I go to one of these things, like Vanderbilt is not far away, FDR, Hyde Park is not far away. This one was owned by Ogden Mills and Ruth Livingston Mills of the Livingston clan we all know about. Every time I go, I just like, you people are so ridiculous. All of you, like, are you kidding me with this? It's just like preposterously large, show-offy place to live in for 4 months out of the year or 6 months out of the year. I don't know exactly what the Ogden Mills clan did, but what was great about it's very fun and interesting to go to. Great art, very ostentatious. Two things were great. One is that all the stern portraits of the men and women of the family in the big great opening hall, all the women looked exactly like Marlon Brando dressed in drag, which was like, I loved it every part.
What
do
you mean,
it.
From the Missouri Breaks?
And yeah, and they're always like, you know, Mrs. Jonathan something. It's like, you people are weird. The other thing is that I went because it was a really actually very cool writing workshop for my 11-year-old and other kids from the area, because it's spring break, where they a woman who works for DC Comics gave them, as we're walking around and looking at stuff, gave them a series of prompts based not necessarily even on the mansion, but on the Titanic. because the people who lived in the mansion had tickets for the outbound Titanic, which didn't get operationalized. And it's just so great.
Did something happen?
Yeah, somehow. and it's so great that like this big, beautiful place that was designed to like show off and like finally memorialize this captain of finance and this scion, whatever of Dutch wealth in New York. Like no one cares about any of that anymore. The only tie-in that's going to get like asses in the seats is if it has anything to do with Titanic. And then the kids break up like, oh, okay. And so that was really awesome. If they do that kind of thing again, I highly recommend it. Otherwise it's another Gilded Age tour in Hudson Valley and they're just ridiculous and rich people are funny.
I like the DC Comics thing. Theme we are developing here. We've got Green Lantern. We've got Marlon Brando, who we all know is Superman's dad. We've got the DC Comics woman. Nick, do you have a DC comic for us?
No, I don't. But I do recommend. There's also a Captain America and the Falcon series, also from the early 70s, where Captain America has to fight against crypto fascists, and it ends at Miami's Flame of International Brotherhood or something like that. But the early 70s, which represented the nadir of comic books in terms of sales tanked, but the pretensions went through the roof. Very good. I have been watching Tehran, which is a TV series that was created by Moshe Zander, the Israeli who was behind Fauda. And Tehran, which has two seasons that are already available. The third season dropped in January. It's available on Apple TV. And it's about an Israeli, Iranian Jew who moves to Israel and then becomes part of a Mossad or an underground secret agent, gets trapped in Tehran, and weirdness ensues. It is what's great about it, and this is also true about Fauda, is that these are shows that have moral complexity in them. And yeah, one of the things that is in Tehran, there are characters who are Jewish, agents, or Israeli agents, rather, Israeli agents who are fighting to destroy the regime because the regime is constantly bombing Israel and it's talking about wiping it out. Then there are people who are in the regime who think they are doing the right thing. And then there are the homegrown dissidents who hate the Iranian regime, but then they also have a lot of beef with Israel. And that kind of triangle is really well you're constantly moving in perspective in a way that's very good. And the second season in particular, this doesn't give away any spoilers, the second season was compared to The Americans, the TV show that about Russian, undercover agents in the 1980s in America. And I talked to the developer, the creators of that. What was great about The Americans, it was the first Cold War text that actually treated Russian patriotism seriously, because we have enough distance and it's a complicated text. And I think Tehran is like that, and it's particularly worth watching, probably, even though the war will probably be over by the time we finish taping this podcast, because it was really over 2 weeks ago, or it was over before it began, et cetera, et cetera. But I recommend Tehran.
I mean, it's going so well. Catherine, what do you have?
On my drive home from Charlottesville, I read a book that was recommended to me by Reason Science correspondent Ron Bailey, who is a fellow enthusiast of histories and novels set in the kind of Mesopotamian, in the Fertile Crescent. The book is called Against the Grain, A Deep History of the Earliest States, and it is by James C. Scott. So this guy, he wrote Seeing Like a State, delightful writer, especially good writer for even non-academics. This book is so good, you guys. It came out in like 2017, something like that. And it basically, it starts by interrogating the idea that, there was kind of roving bands of hunter-gatherers, and they were just so happy and relieved to finally have gotten their act together to create kind of a sedentary, settled lifestyle with domestication of animals and ultimately with agricultural kind of villages and then states. This is what makes civilization possible. And it all started in Mesopotamia. He just wrecks that story, like just totally destroys it, and instead describes how all the different components that we think of as being the foundations of civilization, quote unquote, happened at different times and sometimes millennia apart, like plow agriculture and, the domestication of animals and the idea of some kind of political order. These all happen in different places in different times, and they arise and then they disappear again. And that instead he kind of proposes this idea of a mutual domestication, both of, you know, initially with fire and then kind of plants, livestock, subjects of the state, slaves, and then ultimately women. And it's all in the service of controlling reproduction. So it's just like a totally different way of understanding civilization and the state. And the grain element of it is like there are no states that are not founded on cereal grains. And he says that's because they're taxable, because they are visible, unlike tubers. They're like sitting there in a grain storehouse. They're portable and they're seasonal. So it all comes in at once. And just the idea that like it's wheat's fault that we have taxes. Yeah. And vice versa is such a cool and powerful idea. So Against the Grain by James C. Scott. I am genuinely hyped for this book that is entirely about like growing stuff in Mesopotamia. If that sounded appealing to you, welcome to my party.
So the history of government is the history of carbs?
No, that's the whole thing. It's like the history of government, that's the fake history of government. And this is the real one.
Is it also that grain, like when you have big supplies, you need to guard against people coming and stealing it?
Yes.
I mean, that's so you have like a defense perimeter set up to protect.
Yeah, you're vulnerable to theft in that way, in a way that, you know, if you're a forager and you live in a diverse environment, like no one can steal all the fish and all the tubers and all the berries and all the migratory beasts, right? Like that's not going to happen. So you have kind of a diversity of food sources. But if you double down on grain, it is more vulnerable. And so then somebody rolls up and says, maybe you need a nice, strong king to take care of you.
Yeah. All right. Speaking of people being vulnerable, I saw the movie The Drama, a sort of a romantic comedy, a satire parody of a romantic comedy starring Robert Pattinson and Zendaya. This is a film by Christopher Borgli, who also directed Nick Cage in Dream Scenario. And I think that people sort of look at this cast, the way it's being advertised, this movie is like, oh, this is going to be one of those like awkward kind of, but cutesy millennial sort of deconstructions of the romantic comedy, right? But like fundamentally, it's just going to be a familiar version, sort of maybe lower light and a little bit sort of the jokes won't be quite as obvious kind of thing. No. This is a much, much weirder, much stranger, much more surrealist film. Again, coming from a guy who sort of channeled Lynch and Buñuel in Dream Scenario, this isn't quite as surreal as that movie, but it is a movie about cancel culture and about thought crime. And so the premise is right before Pattinson and Zendaya get married, they're doing the tasting menu at the place where they're going to get married. They got a little drunk. They all go around the table and they say the worst thing they've ever done. So everybody says the two of them and another couple. Everybody says a thing they actually did. Right. So like Alana Haim is in this movie and she locked a mentally challenged kid in the closet and then left him there. Right. Like kind of bad. But she was 15, you know. OK. And then we get to Zendaya's character. And I put this at the very end because it's a spoiler. There's no way to talk about this without spoilers. So you've been spoiled. It's a spoiler. It's a spoiler. Except, Catherine, you're just going to have to learn because this is your job now. And Zendaya is like, yeah. So when I was 15, I planned a school shooting. Okay, what does planned mean? She like got the gun from her dad and like put on camo and brought the gun to it, right? Like, and it's a whole, like she describes this whole act of planning. And then of course, because of some circumstances, didn't go through with it and became an anti-gun activist. And so her female friend immediately sees this as a moment to like pounce on her. Like, I can't be involved with you, right? I know somebody close to me was harmed in a shooting, right? And her husband-to-be, played by Robert Pattinson, is like, what do I do with this person? How do I What do I, right? Just suddenly is it is a revelation that this person he is about to get married to, he doesn't know at all. And he's got to figure out not just whether he knows her, but what the socially approved response to this sort of thing is. On the one hand, mass shootings, school shootings, a taboo topic you can't joke about. And the scene after she reveals this, or just about afterwards, is they go to the wedding photographer. And they're sitting with the wedding photographer, she's like, yeah, so we get a list here. First, we're going to shoot mom. Then we're going to shoot dad. Then we're going to shoot your family, right? And you're like sitting there in the audience, and it's so awkward. And you're laughing. You can't help but laugh. And the movie is trying to help you understand that sometimes there are things in this world that people say, that people think, that go through people's minds, especially when they are young, where there's not just one super clear, pre-approved right response. It can be, in fact, kind of funny and also tragic and awful and the sort of thing that you absolutely cannot joke about. And the movie is trying to make that complex for you. And it's responding, I think, to a sort of social media era sort of idea that, no, we know exactly. We always know exactly how to respond when somebody says something that they shouldn't, when they confess to something, you know, that's outre or whatever, that doesn't fit. And it's such an interesting movie about how do you respond socially, personally, intimately, romantically, when you find out that somebody isn't quite the person that you think they are. Actually, really interesting movie. Strongly recommend it, but it sure isn't the romantic comedy that it is advertised as. All right, folks, that is our show. If you like what we do here, you can support us by going to reason.com/donate. You can support the Reason Roundtable, everything we do at Reason. That's reason.com/donate. Thank you all so much for listening and watching. As always, the Reason Roundtable will return.